Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture. And today I'm here with Steve Adelman, who is here to talk about his new book, Nocturnal Admissions, Behind the Scenes at Tunnel, Limelight, Avalon, and Other Legendary Nightclubs. Steve, thanks for being here with me today.
Thank you.
Could you talk a little bit about why you decided to write about your career, your history with nightclubs and working in nightclubs?
Well, that's a good story, and probably not the answer you'd expect, because I've been a writer my whole life, and I always tell people I'm sort of a writer who got sidetracked in nightlife for 30 years. And even when you're in the nightlife business, you do a lot of writing. You're writing press releases, and you know, I've probably written five novels worth of stuff regarding my businesses. Over time, as a writer, I was sort of taking notes just about things that happen in life. And of course, you know, when you work 20 hours a day, whatever it is, right, as much as I do, those notes happen to come, you know, from your work environment. And I put all these years and years of notes together, and my sort of take on the world is probably a humorous, you know, kind of a humorous look on things. I've been called anything from a young, less attractive Larry David to a, you know, older Jerry Seinfeld, because I have an observational way of looking at things. And sort of those notes sort of made up the book. And I lived in Hollywood for about 10 years. I had an agent. I wrote scripts, things like that. And my agent keeps saying, you've got to write a book because this is really funny. And as an agent sort of book person, he would say, you know, this is a world that people kind of know, but they don't really know. They know the outside of it, but not the ins of it. And my clubs happen to be some of the world's most either famous or infamous clubs. So he thought that made for a very interesting story. Those were all the notes I had. So I set out to write the book, and then the pandemic sort of offered me a little free time.
Which is always really good, right?
It's good, yeah.
No, and it's really great because you give us this bit of an insider, like, what is it like to run the clubs and the ins and outs, and then you'll throw in these really hilarious stories throughout it. So you've broken this book up into kind of three parts that kind of go into your roughly each are around 10 years, right?
Yeah, 3 decades, that's right.
Right, to your career. And you start out by, you're from Boston, right? You're from Massachusetts area. So you start out by kind of talking about your experience in coming to New York. And I think that, and you start with like 1989, I think people have this idea of what New York is like today, but some don't really think about what New York was like in the late 80s and the early 90s. Could you kind of sort of set the picture, sort of set us up for where we're entering, right?
Right. So, you know, I guess you could say New York was less gentrified. So when I came in, the clubs, if you know Manhattan at all, were sort of on the west side of Manhattan, on the river. So, and that area was warehouses and sort of like the Wild West. So that's where sort of all the activity took place. Now you drive by there today and it's all condos, and you know, the High Line runs right there. If you know New York. So it was definitely a little bit more of the Wild West. And I guess what people I found in, you know, doing a lot of press and talking to people about the book, what people's, there's a romantic time. You know, I'm not saying going back to like the 40s and 50s, but, you know, there's a romantic time about New York and nightlife and all the things that were happening. And it's around that time. And I think that was a big part of it, is it wasn't as gentrified as it is now.
Right. And so you kind of set this up. And when you think about just what nightlife looked like at that time, it's very different than what we think about. Even in reading your book, like just the amount of work and effort that went into creating that scene is, it's kind of amazing. Right. And what that looked like.
I mean, that, you know, that was the era. I mean, they called them sort of mega clubs where, you know, these clubs would fit 3,000-4,000 people. I mean, probably the listeners know there's the Limelight, which is, you know, maybe the most famous club ever beyond Studio 54, Tunnel, the Palladium. These were huge spaces, right? So how do you put all these people, how do you fill them? And one of the things you needed to do, you needed to pull from sort of different crowds. So you would have like, I guess you'd call them promoters who would help bring people in, whether they'd been doing birthday parties and events, you know, in a space like that, you're doing 7-8 events, smaller events on one night. You bring everybody together. And when they mix and walk around, that's what makes a great nightclub. So you got people from the gay community, you got people from the hip hop community, all these different communities. And when they come together, I think that's what, that was sort of the recipe in the early 90s for a great nightclub.
Right. And it's interesting how you even got into this, right? You sort of set it up by talking about moving and coming to New York. And you did not come into this thinking that you were going to make a career out of working in nightclubs.
No, in fact, I didn't even go to a nightclub till I was, I don't know, in my mid-20s, which put me, you know, years behind all, when I was in grad school. I started out in graduate school for economics, and I got into the nightclub business because I met a guy and he said, look, I'm looking to have someone help me put the numbers together and the business plan for a nightclub. So me just out of grad school saying, sure, I can do that. He's like, you know, great. Of course, I had no idea what I was doing. I never had done a business plan. But when I started working with him, I sort of got a love for the nightlife business in a way that I saw that you could come up with ideas and do things and then a week later see the result of those things and then start over again. You know, it's like you could build and come up with any idea you wanted to and get sort of immediate feedback. So I thought that was very interesting and challenging. And I ended up going to New York. This is totally what a story this is somehow, I don't even know how I did it. When I was in Boston, one of the first events I did was book RuPaul to play at this club in Boston. I'm thinking to myself, now how, in thinking of today's world, what did I do? Call her on the phone? Did I fax her? Like, how do I even do that nowadays? I didn't email her. I don't know. I don't think she had an agent. So somehow I got her to go to Boston after I had done some pretty bad events. That event was really good. He went back to New York and happened to be staying on the couch of one of the biggest club owners in New York and said, hey, I met this guy in Boston and you should, you know, hire him for the new club you're opening up. So the guy called me, got my number. Again, I don't know how he contacted, maybe left a message on my voicemail. And I went to New York and I interviewed him and he goes, I love you. I said, well, love me. I had zero experience, nothing in nightclub, nothing in business. He says, how many nightclub people do you know that are working on their PhD in economics? I go, you're hired. He was enamored by that. He said, he'd never seen anything like that before. Right. It was a double negative, which he didn't understand. I had no experience in business and no experience in nightclub. So as I say in the book, I had to set out to really learn things. And I sort of call myself the first nightlife detective because I would go around late at night and taking notes. That's one of the ways I started taking notes and saying, you know, I got to learn this business because, you know, I'm suffering from major imposter syndrome here. Like, this is not going to work. And I was staying on the guy's couch.
No, and that was one of the things. Like, one of the things I think was really interesting as I was reading is that you kind of talked about that idea, like, pretending you're Sherlock Holmes and putting on this persona and needing to figure and sometimes not knowing meant you had to eat a whole steak that you probably shouldn't have eaten, right? Like you kind of, there's some things that are, you know, you're just thrown into the fire, but trying to figure out that business and what you needed to do to kind of learn about it, which is really a great part of this insight into like, what do you do when you know nothing and you're going to make this, but you're going to make this work.
Right. And then, well, you know, like I said in the book, like maybe I should go to the bookstore. And in those days, not online, and get like the Nightlife Book for Dummy that doesn't exist. I couldn't ask the guy who just hired me, who was couch I was staying at, like, so what do I do now? So I had to fake it. You know, what do they say? Fake it till you make it, I guess.
And it seems too that there were ways that, you know, you started to meet certain people who had connections or started to have to find ways to like go into other nightclubs without them really knowing that you're trying to poach or learn from them in order to make your nightclubs work and viable.
It was a very strange thing because now this big nightclub opens up in New York and which is none of it was on me, I'm giving credit, right? For this, it's called the Roxy. And it became, you know, famous for 20 years. It was the biggest gay night in the country. It was, you know, any celebrity you can think of from that period. You know, there's a lot of photos of them and things like that in the book. And it was a really big thing. So I got all this credit and I was telling people, wait a minute, it had nothing to do with me, zero. Like I had nothing. And they took that as like false modesty. So my reputation kept growing. So when I went to other clubs, there's a kind of a courtesy. Oh, wow, this guy's a real big shot. We'll let him in. And, you know, yeah, I was there poaching and trying to do what I do. But there's sort of a courtesy in New York. I was a kind of, I guess you could say a mini, despite of myself, kind of a mini celebrity in that world. And, you know, my imposter syndrome just kept getting worse and worse. It just kept, you know, going worse, getting worse and worse.
And sometimes you have these things that happen that you don't even expect them to happen. One of the stories and one of the, you know, you have these characters who you talk about and people that you talk about. But I love this story about your grandmother kind of coming out and visiting. And so sometimes things happen that you didn't expect, but that are great and work really well for you.
Well, all the times things happen that you don't expect, right? That was a thing. And this was one of the really, really unexpected is, you know, my grandma shows up and she's with her, you know, 70, 80 year old friends. They took a bus, you know, to see a Broadway play. And the ironic thing was, I talk about her, you know, going out to dinner and she's very social, you know, 4'2" with a giant hat. You know, we go to Robert De Niro's restaurant somehow. You know, now Robert De Niro is enamored with her. I don't even know the maitre d' brought her because she was so vivacious and such a character. And then she goes to the club. And I talk about these famous club people that worked there in the 90s called the Club Kids, who were sort of dressed up and, you know, crazy and like professional party people. And they saw her and they thought she was the greatest thing ever. And they just took her under their wing. And she's dancing around. I'm like, oh, my God, my Nana's going to die here at the hands of the club kids. I got to do something. And then they left and they said, can we hire her? She was the best. She comes back. We'll pay her $1,500 and we'll call her Disco Grandma. And she'll be the event for the night. I said, I don't think she's for hire. She ain't coming back. She's not for hire. And she didn't know what was going on. She says, oh, my God, these kids, they love me. They're so – look at how they dress. They're so much fun because she herself was a flamboyant dresser. It was something else.
This is great. And like all of this – and you have, right? Like so throughout the book, there's these sort of great stories like that that you bring up. And you also – so another thing I thought was really – I think in that sort of that – so you start out, right, in thinking about New York and being in New York. And you talk about your Yertle the Turtle and your Yertle syndrome. And so I thought that was really interesting and sort of carries through. So could you talk a little bit about that too and kind of what you're seeing?
When I was writing the book, a lot of people, I want to sort of go back a little bit and talk about, you know, the book is really, when you get through the book, it's more than just like sort of fun stories. You know, it's sort of my journey. And, you know, I always say, you know, be careful what you chase, because in the end, all the running better be worth it. So it's a story about me. You know, there's all these things about me being thinking I made it, and then people thinking I was, you know, thinking, oh, I was John Malkovich or I was Steve Jobs. Like, oh, I made it. I'm famous. So what you're chasing. And also in the book, which you're touching upon, is there's a lot of things in business that you learn that are unconventional. In fact, when I was writing the book, one of the publishers thought it was as much of a non-conventional entrepreneurial book than it was anything else. And the idea of there's a Dr. Seuss children's story called Yertle the Turtle, where, you know, he tries to be, and I learned this later on in my career, is that, you know, when you're coming up, you want to be king of everything. And sometimes when you're king of everything, you end up being king of nothing. So I learned that, you know, and when I was starting, I had clubs in New York, LA, Singapore, and I quickly learned that it's better just to focus on things that you can really sort of put your arms around and really keep control over, especially in the Nike business. So lesson learned.
Another thing you have kind of throughout are these laxiums, right, that you sort of share. And so do you want to talk a little bit about your choice? And you have what, about a dozen of them, I think, throughout the book?
Yeah, there's almost 20. And the idea was laxium comes from something that I call learned axiom, which means something I've learned from the nightlife world that I consider now a fact. And some, you know, they cover life, they cover business. You know, I worked with one of the probably the most famous club owner ever in New York named Peter Gation, who was the club king of the 90s. I talk about things that he taught me, right? So one of the things he taught me was, look at, why go out there and open up a club or a bar that fits 300 people, right? When you can spend the same amount of time and open up a club that fits, you know, 2,000 people and then capitalize on your success. So he said, I only open up mega clubs because I don't want my success to be limited by capacity. So, you know, that's one thing. And I also have something that he also taught me, which is called don't let people hear you pee, which means during business meetings, he would just go into the bathroom and you would just hear him going, you know, and to this day, I say it was so distracting that I flushed the toilet before I go because I don't want anyone to hear me. So he taught me both.
No, I love that because you often have people are like, we're on Zoom or I'm going to put a phone in my bathroom. It's like, no, there are places people do not need to find you ever.
Man, I mean, right? He would just leave. There'd be five people that he'd go there and there'd be this loud noise and the door wouldn't be shut. And it was so distracting. Like the meeting was over at that point in time. But I never did that. I learned not to do that.
Another thing is that you also had to figure out in like who you could and could not trust, right? Like you talk about how, like, you know, because often, especially during this time, the nightclub was a cash business in a lot of ways, like, in, you know, and so you have some stories of, like, if you're thinking of that sort of the business savvy in that sense, like navigating who we can trust in these spaces and in this business.
And I it's kind of a funny story now, but I point to a manager who probably stole $30,000 with a really interesting scheme. And he was a guy you would never think would take money. And you know, when you asked, and he had one or two accomplices, and when we asked them why they did it, the only answer was because we could. So right. It's about having systems, like, and anyone can contest in their business, about having systems in place.
Yeah, and you know, I was
the funny ending to that story is we had him taken out in handcuffs to like show people not to steal, right? Actually my partner did that, was very draconian. So as he's getting put and he was serious, as he's getting stuffed in the police car, he yells down the street, so I guess this means you're not gonna give me a recommendation for my next job. Wait, and here's the thing. But I did give him a recommendation for his next job because he went to my competitor. Right. And I thought, this is perfect. I'll recommend him. So it was the ultimate screw you to my competitor.
It works every time, right? Well, and also, you know, in reading this, I was thinking, you know, I was going to nightclubs in like late 80s, early midnight. That was like the time I was going to clubs. But a lot of times I grew up in the Twin Cities. So I was going to First Avenue. I was dancing, but it was more right. But these, you talk about like these huge like set changes and thousands of dollars being spent on just designing. So could you talk a little, because this is sort of incredible and does not happen all over, right? Like, so can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's what made New York. This is a very good point, because, you know, back in the day, New York was considered the heyday of nightlife. It's because of the mega clubs I mentioned and all the things that set changes. And there were a lot of creative people that did this. And I keep going and I point this out in the book. You know, back in those days, there were just a lot of really talented people who took nightlife very seriously. And the other thing about New York is you had the size, you had the population for that, right? But, and you also in New York were able to stay open late. So you could still serve alcohol until 6 a.m. And so you put all those together and you have an environment that's hard to create in other cities. It really is hard. And nightlife in New York, but, you know, and I also point this out in the book, you know, to me, you know, nightlife, whether it's in the Twin Cities or, and this is the underlying, one of the underlying themes of the book, it's always in my mind been a place where people can sort of get together and meet and talk. And in today's, you know, divisive world, you know, sort of the differences sort of meld away when you're at clubs talking together. I've always told people, if you really want to learn something, you know, go to a nightclub and just start talking to people who you would never talk to, you know, 9 to 5 during the day. So I think that's the sort of the uniformity and sort of the shared experience that we all have, whether it's the local bar in where you are. What's the town again?
I'm in Macomb. Yes, in Macomb. We have a local bar.
Right. No. It's, whether it's the local bar in Macomb or, you know, the giant nightclub in Las Vegas, right? That sort of interaction of one-on-one is still the same.
Right. Which is really great. And you kind of talk about how what you learned in New York, and then you go back to Boston and you talk about how you were going to, you know, find a way to make what you had learned work, even if the club can't stay open till 6 a.m. or serve alcohol all night, right? And how that can work. So what was that kind of like, leaving New York and then going into a whole different environment?
That's a great question. When I left, this has a lot of interesting subplots to it, that question, because when I left New York, it's because Giuliani had, you know, declared war on New York. It wasn't just, it was the clubs in the West Side. It was art. It was everything, right? Clean up Times Square. You know, he's the same. I'm not a big fan. I won't get into that, but he's the same Giuliani as he is today. And I remember standing next to him when he was, had a shutting down Limelight and a big press conference. And, you know, it's like the old James Comey said, the worst place, the most unsafe place to ever be is between Giuliani and a microphone. So I watched that. I ended up in Boston. And I said to myself, this coming together of all these groups can really happen in Boston, but it's going to have to happen in a different way. And then I hit upon one thing that people hadn't really focused on. It's the largest student population in the world there, right? So I thought, okay, you know, fun students, there's a gay community, we can recreate this in a different way. And we were able to do that. So that was a fun experience and a learning experience, because, you know, before that, Boston was known as, you know, hey, a man's man power, you're drinking beer, you know, and that kind of stuff, right? Go to the pub in Southie, and it's also known for, you know, bands too. It's a great live music town. But it was interesting because I found, and I even allude to this in the book, is that, you know, people, I found out people are the same wherever they go, you know, whether it's Boston, LA, Singapore. I found people and people in nightclubs in general are pretty much all the same.
Yeah, along those lines, you have some of these places you sort of give us an insight. And so one of the things I loved was when you were talking about road managers, and you have like your 4 different types of tour managers that are going that you see as you're coming through the club. And those kind of that made me laugh, right? You have That's these funny, great insights lot. Into that.
The people in the music industry just love that part. They're like, oh my God, you nailed that. Because it's, you know, everybody that's ever dealt with that sort of behind the scenes in live music, But I don't know if anyone's ever categorized them and put, you know, labels on them. But yeah, that's good. Yeah, thanks. Because a lot of people from the industry like that part.
Yes. No, it's wonderful. Right. So you have these little things. I have to say that I really love the story. And so you have all these stories, but I have the Perry Farrell story and how Perry Farrell was brought along his sort of his entourage, which was not the entourage you would expect, and right. Wasn't really sure he would be able to DJ for this large club or this larger audience was a lovely story of thinking about sort of giving us insight again into some of these performers and they're sort of what they are thinking when they're coming into these spaces.
That's right. Yeah. Yep.
So could you talk, another thing that you started to do that you were starting to see was that you could, and this goes a lot, you tell, one of the stories you tell is about Iggy Pop, but like that you were playing, doing one thing. So playing music early in the night, in sort of the day, right. And then sort of really quickly transitioning over to a dance floor.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So could you talk about like that business wise and what that kind of was like, right. And looked and like that, for that, you?
When I came to Boston, the club had existed in one form or another that I sort of took over. We took over like six clubs, and they had started a model where they would do live bands early, a regular concert, then kick everybody out and then do a dance night after. And the reasoning was, you know, you only can make money when you're open. So the problem with that is you got to transition between the two groups. And in the book, I use a particularly extreme example where you had Iggy Pop, you know, playing early. And then afterwards, we were doing this big party for this porn star called Jenna Jameson. I think the event was called Erotic Island. So you have to think about it now. You have to set up all the props. But when the band comes, a band just wants four walls and a black room, right? They have their own visuals and stuff. So we had all this stuff stored, you know, up in the trusses, like giant beach balls. And we had big, giant, you know, 60-pound bags of sand off to the side. Well, the Iggy Pop crowd, it gets a little rowdy. So they were like all of a sudden and very loud. So the sound was reverberating. And now you have all these giant suns, you know, that are hanging from the trusses falling into place, right? All the beach balls falling out and people finding bags of sand and while the show's going on. And, you know, we had lifeguard chairs off to the side. They were pushing them, you know, into the venue because people were climbing on for better views of the show. So it was a big chaotic scene. So in the book, I talk about, I don't know if you know Spinal Tap, but there's a manager, the manager with the cricket bat, that was like his manager, and he was losing his mind, right? So the story goes, I'll sort of give it away, is that he's going crazy, threatening me with a cricket bat, and I pull him off to the side and I go, I have a solution, right? So at the end, the band goes upstairs, I bring the porn star over to, and they sign autographs, and they say hi, and they take pictures. The manager comes to me and said, the greatest idea, the greatest show we've ever played.
Well, and you know what's really fascinating? Like throughout the book, there's these ways in which you kind of talk about how you have to navigate, whether it's inviting like someone to, you know, you can come back and see the show, or you can bring your kids and meet Justin Timberlake, whatever it might be, right? But that you're also like showing about how this, like sometimes the best laid plans mean, you know, don't work. Like you have to think on your feet, and how do you sort of navigate, and how do you, like think about what do people want or need, and how can you help people to get us all to the point we need to be at?
There's a laxium, you know, I have in the book, which basically says is the power of yes, which is there's always a solution. You just got to stay calm and be ready to think out of the box, and don't be stuck in what you thought was going to happen. Deal with what they're not. And certainly Nightlight teaches you that.
Yeah, like I think, you know, in reading this, there's so many different personalities, and especially like, you know, I bring up your tour manager, but you have this, you starting to talk about this with celebrities too. Like there's so many personalities you have to navigate. Sometimes you can't even look at someone, right? And so like that, bringing that up and like sort of talking through how you have navigated and negotiated that is really fascinating throughout the book.
And my, I always tell a funny story is that when everybody, when you're writing the book, said, oh, there's a lot of photos in the book, but really none of me, there's one or two of me, but none of me in celebrities. So everyone's like, well, you got to have pictures. I said, I don't really have any. I said, the only picture I have of me that I could find, there's a picture of me in front of Avalon in Hollywood, where it's, there's, I think it's Nicole Richie was her name, Paris Hilton. And they're promoting a show called The Simpletons or something. Simpletons?
The Simple Life of, yes.
Oh, Simple
yes.
Life.
Right, I know right, exactly right. What show you're talking about. Yes, it's those right, two. Okay.
Yeah. Right. I'm standing there and I'm looking to my right and there's a giant steer, like, you know, a 2-ton steer. Like, looks like it's going to kick me in the, you know, because they're promoting it. I don't know. Maybe they're going out in the country. That maybe that was the show,
yes,
right?
Yeah, that was
it. Right. All right, right. So there's a look on my face like, you know, it's right out of like, you know, epic fails. And that's the only, I said, I don't think you want that photo, but that's the only photo I have. The point being that, you know, my thing is just to leave people alone. And you know, I don't run up and take pictures. And there's an old, a famous, one of the most famous Hollywood agents, a quote from him, a famous quote is, you know, talent always rules. And that means, you know, if it's good to have people in your club and they're respecting the club, great. Treat them however they want to be treated and be, you know, throw your ego out the door because in the end it's business.
Right. And so you know, you're New York, Boston, this very East Coast, and then you move all the way to LA and Hollywood and that area. So what was that like, that transition from, I mean, East Coast living and East Coast folks are quite different.
A chart. I have a chart in the book, East Coast. Right. Yeah.
Yes. Which somebody, I lived in Philadelphia for a long time. So somebody who is very East Coast, who knows that East Coast, that chart really made me laugh. Cause I'm like, yes, right. Yes.
Yeah. It's a big, it was real, you know, I suffered a bunch of culture shock. You know, and that really was a culture shock going from New York to Los Angeles. But, you know, I had a lot of experience. I think nightlife taught me well of, you know, sort of observing and patience and sort of understanding your environment. If you remember in the book, I even have like a little sort of like pseudo script of a few pages about, you know, sort of a typical dialogue that happens in LA. I call it transactionalism. Is, you know, it's a one industry town, as far as my experience was. So everybody wants to know what you can do for them or not do for them. And you sort of just get it. You sort of deal with it. But here is the funny thing about it. As you go to different places, people have I use the word prejudice, but a preconceived notion of nightclub guys, right? So in New York, you go out to eat and you're like, oh my God, he must be like Tony Montana or, you know, from Scarface or, you know, so they look at you one way. In LA, they love nightclub people. I don't know why. I kind of know why now, but they love them. So you're put on a pedestal because they don't have a lot of nightlife there. And their minds, right, and people in the entertainment industry, oh, all celebrities go to your clubs. So you must be able to help them. So, wow, you're a really important guy. None of that's true because I don't even talk to any of the celebrities when they go there and know none of them. But it doesn't matter. You get treated. They treat you like you're a king. And then I talk about Singapore. I go there and they treat you like, you know, they bow like you're a CEO of, you know, you're a businessman. Oh my gosh, look at this big brand. And they talk about brands. And so you're considered a very serious businessman. So you never consider that anywhere else. I've never was anywhere else in the world where people could, you know, ask me my business advice. Like, you know, will you lecture? No, lecture on business, which I did at the Singapore Management University. Like, okay.
I can tell you it all. Yes. No, I mean, my university has one of the majors you can major in is like music business, right? But this is something that is not it's not, you know, an entertainment industry and entertainment business isn't something that we have all over the place, right? So yes, we usually don't think about it.
This is not even talking about music business or nightclub. This is talking about the success of a businessman. You know, it's like, you know, I'm Richard Branson or something, or who knows, you know, they want to know my business acumen. They, you know, they like, that the industry is just another industry. So it was, I found that very fascinating. And I also talk about, if you ever want to find a culture, just go to the airport and look at their bookstores. And if you ever want to know about a city, in Singapore, it's all business books, right? And in LA, it's what? Just tabloids and, you know, the Hollywood Reporter and...
Right. And I do love, like, you kind of, you know, there are things like you talk about sort of the A list, B list, C list. You have some sort of lists in there. And so you talk about that celebrity culture in L.A. and Hollywood in those areas and things that people know. But you kind of lay it out, which I think is really helpful. Like, I don't know if helpful is the right word, but I love that you're doing that. Right. Like you're kind of like, yes, we you know, we often talk about A list stars or B list or C list or other. But here's what that kind of means. And
right,
here's how
what it means. Right. Here's exactly who's on that list and who's not. Right.
Yeah.
Right. And then I go into, I think that chapter is actually called alphabetical order. Right. Because then you go into the gray areas. Right. Oh, my God. There's B's that think they're A's, but then A's that are only A pluses who would never be considered an A, who think those B's are C's. So there's a whole world that moves. And by the way, I don't get any of it. I'm sort of one. I don't use that. I'm not the guy. We have like doormen and other people who, you know, use the alphabetical thing. But, you know, I observe it. I learn it. I get it.
And I love about that. And that they're like, and also like that idea, like nightclubs, like there are people who have spent a lot of time sort of navigating that and that system and really know, and that's their job. And I appreciated that too, of getting people to think about, yes, we think about, like you said, nightclubs and, or that every celebrity wants to own a nightclub in the LA Hollywood area. But that there are the nightclub workers are really knowledgeable about these things and sort of know how to move through them and what that looks like too. So there's a lot of respect for, the folks, not just the folks whose name is out there, but the folks who are doing that work every
day. It's a nuanced in the bigger cities. It probably gets, you know, less nuanced as the cities get smaller and smaller, but same idea. Everybody knows it's the same kind of idea, but there's a lot of nuances in making all that work and a lot of tricks to the trade. And I talk about, you know, one of the things I always laugh about in LA, I said, you know what? The guy has a guest list. I don't know if there's anybody even on that. I think it's a fake list that they use every day. He knows. If he doesn't know, he's not the right guy. And you know, so he knows who's who, right? So people go, I'm on the guest list. And when you say that, well, you got a problem.
Well, and you, at one point you talk about, like, you mentioned, you talk about Prince, but you said, like, you don't even know sometimes if the person's calling really does work for, you use Prince, but whoever it might be,
all
right? Like,
that's,
sometimes it could be like, is this person just yanking my chain?
Right.
Is this really going to happen? So there's all of that. There's all of this kind of
people using and, you know, trying to, you know, I call it the Hollywood hustle. And as you know, that story ends up pretty funny, but that particular example of Prince, but yeah, you got to navigate that and you got to have the people and, you know, and it, the size of the operation isn't easy too, because, you know, when that place, for example, when my club in Hollywood, when that place was going, you're talking about almost 20 bartenders and three or four different entrances to get in and, you know, security guards and 2,000 people. And so there's a lot to manage.
Right. And losing your shoes at some point when you're going to roll the red carpet.
Right, right. Yeah, getting your shoes stuck on glue because the opening night, the guy's late with the carpet, of course. And you decide, well, I'm going to pull a Jimmy Hoffa. And those shoes are gone for good.
So one of the things I really love too, like you mentioned going to Singapore, is you kind of talk about what it means for you to go from New York to Boston to Los Angeles and then like literally halfway across the world, right? And kind of that this wasn't, at least for you, these decisions were not ones where you were like, all right, I'm just going to send some people over there. But you really went all in. Like you're like, I'm gonna go here, I'm gonna learn the language, I'm gonna try and be a part of this space. So could you talk a little bit about like those kind of decisions?
Yeah, that was a tough one because so to follow, you know, I kind of started in Boston and then going to New York and then in LA, and then at the time I had clubs in all those cities. And then Singapore came about because they were building a large casino, and the guys that that own it was Sheldon Adelson and the guys that had the Venetian were opening up the biggest casino in Asia, and they wanted me to open up a club there. And that was a tough one because that to me was, okay, when are you going to get a chance in your life to do this? So I really, at that point in time, chose adventure, meaning you're getting older. I didn't even know. I thought Singapore was Hong Kong. I mean, they're not even close to each other. I didn't have any idea. I'd never been to Southeast Asia. And I go, when are you going to get this opportunity? So it was a tough one because I thought I was going to be going back and forth. And that I get into the Yertle syndrome thing there because I'm in Singapore. You know, it's the longest flight in the world is LA to Singapore. So not over 19 hours nonstop. And that's a tough one. So you're not flying back. You're not commuting back and forth on a weekly basis when, you know, and it's not a cheap flight. So, and then when I got there, that was another, you know, sort of culture shock. I had to learn how to navigate business. You know, it's predominantly, there's the Singaporean culture intertwined with the Chinese culture. And now I know why there's no nightclubs, American nightclubs or nightlife brands in China. It's not easy. It was tough doing business there, which precluded me from, you know, going back and forth. So I was there for over 5 years and I only got back to the States three times.
Which is rough, right?
Rough. You lose track of everything. You lose track of your life and it's the opposite, you know, exactly 12 hours time difference too. So, you know, days, you know, you just, that's tough. You lose track and then you have to make a decision. Am I going to live here? Am I coming back? So I decided to make a trek back to the U.S.
And then COVID hits, right? So your business, your livelihood is based on these spaces that when COVID hits are shut down, right? And so can you talk a little bit, right? And you just, you know, that move back and what that meant for you and also what sort of you were sort of seeing with COVID and what was happening.
I mean, you know, the worst thing about COVID is, and then you got the stops and starts, right? So, you know, it's a tough business, and my venues are independent, which means it's not like I'm part of a chain. So, you know, they function and, you know, it's, we're on an island. So, if you remember, you know, COVID, then, oh, it's going to get better. And then they sort of like change the rules and you start again, and then you stop again. And that's death. You bring staff back and so, you know, we decided just to let it sit through the whole process. It's just too hard to, you know, to, and now, you know, as we come out of COVID, I see a very interesting world out there that, you know, I'm working on to try to, I guess we maybe capitalize on. I see interaction and nightlife a little bit different than before COVID. I see people wanting to, you know, they value, you know, that sort of getting together a lot more than they, you know, because of all that, but they want to do it simply and easily. And, you know, in a nice environment where in my world, that big nightlife world has moved a lot to Las Vegas and places like that, where the, you know, the DJs are paid $1.5 million to play for a few hours. And, you know, it costs $5,000 to sit down at a table. So I see it moving away to a more, I get maybe a more simpler time, you could say, but a more ease of interaction. So that's what I'm working hard on right now.
Well, and you have gone, right? So New York and LA areas both have lots of transplants, people coming from all over. And, you know, when you were in Boston, you were in the space where you had lived before. So now you're in Memphis and you kind of talk about the different struggles with coming in and living in a space that you did not grow up in, that you're not a part
That's right.
What that kind of means and how you have to negotiate that too, as a business person and just as wanting to really making that space your home and what that looks like.
Yeah, it was interesting because when I was in Singapore, I ended up here in Memphis because my father was becoming ill and I have family here. And I thought, okay, like, and then I was introduced to a project here that I really liked. So, but it wasn't necessarily that I was going to stay here. Like I was LA and Memphis and, you know, I'll do a project in Memphis, right? It's a historic town, great music town. But then, you know, the pandemic changed that equation. So then I sort of made this the permanent home because, you know, it's been going on for a few years and it's a small town. So it's a huge adjustment for me. And I thought Singapore was small, you know, and it's different, but I'm learning a lot. I mean, the tongue-in-cheek chapter, heading of the last chapter is called, you know, I go through all these things in the last chapter in Memphis is called Culture Shock. Right? and so, you know, I've seen things that I've learned a lot. Like I never spent time in the South. So I'm learning a lot about the South and people, and it's very interesting. And so, yeah, it's been quite an adjustment and doing business in a smaller setting. You just keep learning. You just keep moving forward.
Right. And I love that you kind of sort of introduce us to all these sort of different aspects of nightlife and culture and what that kind of means to be in this space and be in this business. And like what you said at the sort of earlier on, that people use these nightclub places wherever they might be to meet new people, to have this sort of shared experience that they can have. And it might, you know, there are some elements of it that might look different, but we're all right. We're going out and we go to the nightclub and hoping for that sort of shared experience.
That's right. It's, you know, nightlife in all its forms is sort of a universal experience where people can sort of leave their day behind and let themselves be. That's what I found in New York. Just be who you want to be. And let off some steam and enjoy yourself if it's only for a few hours. I think that's essential, I think, to our culture. I mean, I say in the book, think about a world where there is no nightlife. It's, you know, it's a hard place to imagine.
And like you said, so you think nightlife sort of moving in sort of a direction of being, you know, less... like being more intimate, maybe. I don't know if that's the right word. Are there any other kind of trends or things that you're seeing or that you are hoping for in these next few years that will happen?
I you know, being an old man now in the, you know, I'm like the guy that's still standing right in the industry. You know, I see a lot of people, everything that comes around, goes around, right? So I was just in LA and everyone's like, oh, we're doing these really exclusive VIP clubs where you have to be a member. And I was like, I did that crap in 2000. I'm like, are you kidding me? Like they're bringing it around because younger people have never seen it. And all that's good, by the way. It's not that. I take a more less reactionary view. And I just think that people have bowed. I think we're going into a recession right now. I think there's a lot of money that young people have bowed during the recession. I mean, during the pandemic, and that's all going to come due. And I think so. People aren't going to have the money that they've had, you know, maybe before the pandemic. And I also think they want, in my view, global view, is they want an easier, more interactive experience where they can talk to people in an environment where they can just meet people. And I think that's going to be where things are going to go. So that's what I'm working on right now. So,
which sounds great. And I have to say, because you brought up the, you know, members only, your idea of having three different colors of cards, like membership cards that were numbered like 0 to 99 I was like, this is genius.
Right. Worked. It's all right. That's what I'm saying. It's kind of ridiculous, but you go to Hollywood and you just have to do what you got to do. And there you go. Everybody wins.
You all get a card. It's going to be a different color, but you all get a card.
Right. Right. It's exclusive, but we printed 4,500 of them, but that's okay.
So, I mean, we could probably talk about like nightclubs and everything forever, but I'll ask you my sort of final question. Like, so is the book out now or is it coming out? And is there any, okay, so it's out. Are there any promotional things that you have going on with this or anything else you're working on that, you know, you want to promote?
Well, I've been doing a book tour. The book came out June 7th. It's available everywhere, Amazon, anywhere where books are sold. You know, I have an event coming up in Minneapolis, and then one in Chicago. So I'm going to email you the Chicago date at the bookseller. But so we've been doing a few of these, and so that's it. I'm working on sort of my next iteration of nightlife and I'm really enjoying with my wife, and I'm still on the pandemic lifestyle, so I got to move away from that. I mean, my dog is, if I spend more than 2 hours away from my dog, I think I'm getting separation anxiety. So once I get through all these phobias, I'll be back out there and you'll see me.
All right. Well, it has been wonderful talking with you, Steve Adelman, who has written Nocturnal Admissions, Behind the Scenes at Tunnel, Limelight, Avalon, and Other Legendary Nightclubs. Steve, thanks so much for talking with me for New Books in Popular Culture.
Appreciate it.